This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Welcome back to Extended. I'm Peter Johnson. Today's episode is about flying, what it really looks like once you're past the headlines and in the air. I'm joined today by the authors of Warbirds to Workhorses, a book that takes you from iconic warbirds to everyday workhorses and tells the honest story about pilot judgment, workload, supreme air-to-air photography. We'll challenge some assumptions and talk about what these aircraft teach you once the romance wears off. Bob, Keith, welcome to Extended.
Hello.
Right, let's first kick off and oil the wheels a little bit by finding out a little bit about how you got into aviation. Keith, let's start with you. Where's the aviation bug come from for you?
Well, in fact, in reality, the photography bug came first. As a 3 or 4 year old, my father was a good photographer, stuck a camera in my hand and taught me how to use it. And by the age of 4 or 5, I used to work in a dark room we had at home, processing black and white films and printing the images. So first and foremost, it was about photography. When I went to senior school, I was probably about 12, and the school overlooked an airfield. And being an inquisitive brat, along with a number of other inquisitive brats, at the end of the day, we'd jump on our push bikes and cycle down to the local airfield and explore. And it was an amazing exploration. And it was the first visit I made, and I became hooked on it. From that point onwards, I was down there regularly, surprisingly enough, with a camera in my hand, taking photographs, and that's how, in many respects, the aviation photography started. So much of a bug that I started to fly at about the age of 18. Unlike Bob, who flew commercially all his life, all my time was spent private flying. Although I did spend time doing sales demonstration flying, and I also spent time doing ferry flying, both all around Europe and also in South Africa and Australia, and also doing transatlantic ferry flying, which was extraordinary experience and somewhat dangerous. But it culminated in doing work with air-to-air photography. And I started off way back in 78. So I've been doing it for the best part of 48 years. So you'd think by now I might have got it right. And then working for magazines. And I've developed it onwards. Since 2000 and around 2000, Bob and I got together and started working together on magazine features. And Bob then can tell his own story.
So I started flying when I was 16 at Southend. I'm an Essex boy. I started there, and then when I was 18, I got my license, my pilot's license, and then I was really lucky to get selected for RAF training. And so I went through 5 years of RAF training, firstly part-time, then full-time, and then I lost my medical. These are corrective glasses that I'm wearing. I just got too short-sighted for the level of training that I was at the time. I got chopped. I got briefly reinstated by the Fleet Air Arm the following year, and then chopped again because my eyesight had dropped by exactly the standard that they'd dropped their standards by.
Right.
And I lost it again. Yeah, I can't make it up. So I kept the interest in military flying because I loved the fast jet world and fighter planes and things like that. And I became a commercial pilot and worked in the airlines. But in my spare time, I always had that yearning to fly military planes. And I, as soon as I could afford it, I bought a share in a little trainer called a Yak 52, which is a Russian trainer. And then later on, I bought a thing called a Nanchang, which is a Chinese version of it, which is a ground attack variant. And then about 6 years ago, I bought a Yak 3 World War II fighter, and I still campaign that around Europe. It's based in Belgium. And I had a parallel career as a writer, and started writing for the opposition, actually, for Flyer magazine, 90. And I moved across to Pilot in 2000 and a bit, and worked with Keith ever since, off and on. And we felt that we wanted to do something with these flight tests that we write. I mean, I've done hundreds. Keith has done thousands of air-to-airs, and they just seem to be like waste material. We've sold them all over the world. We keep the second rights to the stories that we do.
Right, okay.
So we sold them on to magazines everywhere, all over, literally across the world. Keith's got incredible connections, but it still felt like a waste. And the other thing was that we felt that some of the pictures that we'd taken weren't used as much as we'd like them to be. And so they'd ended up on, you know, the old metaphor, cutting room floor, and we wanted to resurrect them. And then we loved those sort of coffee table books from a few decades ago that you'd end up with, then either lovely old cars or planes. And so we wanted to recreate it. So that's why we got together with this book. It's not going to be the only one. We're going to do Warbirds to Workhorses part 2, 3, 4, 5, probably eventually.
Okay.
And, oh, yeah, well, we were approached by Pen and Sword, who Keith's worked for years and years, doing very niche books about things like the RAF in the 80s or the 70s, and really, really incredible books in their own right. And they just wanted us to make these lovely style of coffee table books. And the only thing I had about that I felt that I wanted was these old books that I'm referring to were A3. And we couldn't do it. It's too expensive with modern processing and production. It's too expensive. So the one thing our book does, it opens up. You don't break the spine to open the book up. It lays completely flat when you open it. And they're beautiful things.
Yeah.
These lovely double page spread photographs that Keith's done. They're just awesome things. They're oil paintings, you know, to attract your eye as you walk into a nice, my imagination is a beautiful plush room with a big coffee table, and there's this book, and you're just drawn to this fantastic book. That's where we.
It's really interesting, actually, that you say that, Bob, because when I started reading it, I wasn't quite sure what to expect, if I was honest. And the more I got into it, I know the term eye candy is used an awful lot, but it's really, really important, I think, that something is attractive to you and not just the words in a book like this. So totally get it. And, you know, it goes without saying that the visuals in the book are absolutely stunning and worth the book itself. But that's why you wanted to put that book together. But it's not just a collection of flight tests, is it? Feels like a bit of a journey. What story were you trying to tell the reader and get that experience to them as you go through the book?
I certainly would say that Bob and I sat down on a number of occasions and reviewed various lists of what contents we would like in this first book. And we knew that volume one had to be a bit special to get the right kind of attention that we were hoping to get. But we tried to put a nice balance in there. So we tried to put something in for all people of an aviation ilk that would be interested in them. So there's everything from 1940s, 50s jets, iconic jets, through to the Yak 3 and other warbirds. But also at the opposite end of the scale, you've got some amazing workhorses that we've had access to and flown. And I pick out one of those, the Helio Courier, which was a very interesting aeroplane when the United States were operating out in Laos, because they used to operate for an airline called Air America. And Air America was known to be the CIA's most secret airline. So this aeroplane had a real culture around it and a real historic sensation. And so we picked that one out as one of the ones we wanted to go for. And it really is a true workhorse. But interestingly enough, I think the back of the book, when Bob goes and flies a Spitfire simulator, and I think it's a brilliant piece of journalism. And I was standing alongside the simulator taking photographs while Bob was flying it and crashing this Spitfire into the water and crashing it into the top of houses until the message got through that he had to react really quickly to what was happening around. And it changed Bob's mindset. And it was fascinating. Yeah. In the space of perhaps an hour and a half, that whole process came through. The article in the back of the book, I think, is a great one. Over to you, Bob.
It was really interesting to do it. We've got a mutual friend called Eski Lamdahl, and he was the pilot of a Sea Fury that crashed at Duxford a few years back. And ironically, one of our fellow journalists, we call him Onions, but it's Dave Unwin, and he was in the back at the time, and this thing came down like a manhole cover. And I wanted to make sure that I could deal with my aircraft the same as he had. This guy's a European test pilot. He now runs the Red Bull Warbird fleet. This guy is the top of the tree. He flies a F-104 Starfighter in his spare time. I mean, he is the best of the best. And even he ended up in A&E. And I think most people would have ended up in A&E or the morgue. And so I really need to nail it. So that was a really important part of our book, actually, wasn't it, Keith? And it's,
yes.
And we took that particular story. We didn't just rewrite what we'd already done. We updated and modernized the story to the cutting edge of how you deal with an engine failure in a single engine aircraft. Exactly what do you do? When do you do it? How do you do it? And hopefully we might save a few lives or...
Well, if we save one life, Bob, that's all that matters.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. There's a little bit of, what's the word? Philanthropy, I suppose, in the book that we are trying to put the stuff out there for the general public. And
well, that's it's a really interesting read, actually, because although I flew very simply many moons ago, I wouldn't have thought that an article like that would be that attractive to read. But actually it was quite gripping.
Yeah.
You know, if you say to somebody, here's an article about somebody flying in a flight simulator, most people would just say, oh, not for me.
Turn off.
But I did find it quite gripping. And a lot of the others, and if I can maybe just jump ahead a little bit, in the vampire chapter, Bob, you talk about workload rather than difficulty and how it dominates your experience. How does workload shape risk in those older jets compared to some of the modern aircraft that you fly?
The older jets they're higher workload because they've got less automation. The modern jets, the workload's different. The airplanes have a lot more safety written into the software. And in fact, like a Typhoon, for instance, you're flying the airplane, if you're doing what's called standoff, which is firing over the horizon, you're not actually looking at your enemy. It's all on a radar system or whatever. You actually fly the airplane with your feet, with the rudder bars. You don't fly it with your hands. You use your hands to operate the weapon systems. So it's a completely different mindset. The Vampire was the first of two jets at the time in 1940, one was the Meteor twin engine, one was the Vampire single engine. They didn't quite make the war or World War II. They were just operational at the end of the World War II. But my God, you couldn't get more different than that.
Yeah.
Compared to today, completely different ballgame. And to start the Vampire, it's the hardest engine cycle, starting cycle that I've ever experienced in any aircraft. And I mean, I've flown 300 different fixed wing types of plane. It's so complicated. In fact, I didn't even write the bit. I actually handed it over to the owner of the plane to write that part, because it's just too much for me to understand. And I've been in that plane twice now. And I'm quite a quick learner. It's just one of my lucky attributes. I've got plenty of bad attributes, but I'm a quick learner when it comes to airplanes, and I can't understand it. And we just got Mark to write it, didn't we, Keith?
Absolutely right. And at least that way, we got it right.
You mentioned some pretty iconic aircraft then, and you've flown quite a few, and they come with, they really come with big reputations, some of these aircraft. When you were flight testing them, how did those reputations play on your pilot skills and the pressure to fly these aircraft?
Some of them, the reputations are wrong. Some of them are right. Probably the most iconic one, I think, of all of them was the Mustang, the P-51, which is the American Spitfire, if you want to call it that. Being told what an incredible airplane performance-wise and how difficult it was and everything. And there's this sort of status thing that you get with warbird pilots that they think that we're like sky gods. And I actually found it really, really all right to fly. And ironically, the T6 trainer, the Harvard trainer, which is the one that comes before it, I found more difficult to fly. And they always said that in World War II, that it was cheaper for you to crash a Harvard than a Mustang. So that's why you flew the Harvard first.
Yeah.
And I get it. I think that's true. I thought the Mustang was I'm not going to say a piece of cake. I mean, you've got to work up to that standard of operation. And I worked my way up through the little Pitts biplane trainer and then the T6 Harvard. And then I flew the Mustang. And then that set me really nicely up to fly my plane that I've got, the Yak 3, which is a little bit more difficult again. It wasn't an anticlimax because it's a fantastic plane. It's my favorite. I say it quietly because I don't want to upset my Yak 3, but the Mustang's my favorite plane. And I'd say that some airplanes, there's a lot of
myth.
Misinformation.
Yeah, there's a lot of myth around some of them. But interesting enough, Bob, one of the observations I've made, I mean, you took the P-51 in your stride. You even went to the States and got a type rating on it. But it stood you in good stead because the first time I really sort of seen you slightly nervous of an aeroplane is when you were going to fly the Yak 3. And that was that is an absolute brute. And you convey that story in the book so beautifully, particularly about your feelings and in a language that some may seem as slightly colourful, but it's just from the heart. And that's just how you felt about that lovely aeroplane. Hopefully now, you know, with the hours you have on it and the number of displays you've done, you've mastered the aeroplane. Or it may just be one of those aeroplanes that you never really master and you just have to keep on your toes. What do you think, Bob?
If I haven't flown that aeroplane for 4 weeks, I'm nervous of it. I still am. I've got 200 hours on it, and it's unlike anything else that I've flown. I mean, I felt comfortable in the Mustang after 5 or 6 hours, and it was the only insurance that stopped me going solo in the airplane in America. Otherwise, I would have soloed it, the guys told me. And I was there with a friend, and the two of us, for whatever reason, we did the fastest conversion to type. Sorry, that's fireworks going off in the background now. I have no idea why, but there you go. And the two of us managed to do our training in 8 hours, and the course is normally 12 to 16.
Right.
But we both felt totally comfortable in that plane. I can't say the same for the Yak. The Yak is still surprising me today, 5 years down the road. I'm still nervous of the ship, and it's got my total attention. And I don't know, maybe because I'm older, I've got a thicker yellow streak running down me. I don't know, but it really does take my a long time to get comfortable in that aeroplane.
And an interesting knock-on from that, Bob, was when we did the air-to-air photographs of that aeroplane for the original article, which appear in the book. That was a really tricky shoot because of relative speeds, relative performances, and everything else. And it was really hard work for you. That was one I've not seen you sweat so much as you did that day.
Well, we've got a funny thing, me and Keith, that we do. We've got lots of adages. One of them is three strikes and you're out. In old English, it's once is circumstance, twice is happenstance, and three times is an act of war. But there's three things telling us not to do something, we don't do it.
Yeah.
And on that particular, that first shoot Keith's talking about, ironically, we had a beginner camera ship pilot, and he could talk the talk, but he couldn't walk it. And we told him a few things for the brief before we went, and we said we mustn't turn left after takeoff because of noise abate out of this airfield. I said to him, do not fly the camera plane below 150 knots. Because I've got to put my airplane in position so Keith can take pictures of the plane. And I said, and don't fly me through cloud, because I don't want to fly the airplane like on instruments, like you have to do with, like an airliner.
Yeah.
And the first thing he did after takeoff was turn left.
Turn left.
And
right.
Second thing, I started to feel, we were over Clacton in Essex, and I could feel the controls getting loose in my hands. And I looked down. You hardly look away from the camera plane when you're formating on a plane. So I'm not looking inside my own cockpit, but I did glance down, and I'm doing 125 knots instead of 150. So I'm about to stall. And then I looked in front of me, and there was a bloody great cumulus cloud. And I just said, knock it off, Keith.
Yeah. Yeah.
If either of us or any of us in the plane say knock it off, it means you go home. You don't have to quantify it. You wait till you land on the ground and then you can have a chat. It's not pointed. There's no fingers pointing. It's just, this isn't right. We're going home. And that's what we did, didn't we? The second time,
yeah,
we had another guy, a newer guy, who ironically was way better. And it was one of the easier flight tests, I think, and the easier air to airs that we did. And we got some incredible pictures in the book. Beautiful, beautiful images that we took, didn't we?
Indeed. And to be fair, Bob, you know, we work at these photo shoots. They don't just happen by accident. They're carefully planned. They're carefully...
Keith, talk us through that process. Talk us through how you set something up like this. Take us through, you know, Bob mentioned a few bits there, but how would you go about it?
Invariably, once the subject of the photo of the flight test is chosen for whatever reason, we plan a camera ship that will work with it. And it's important that speeds are and performance is similar. It's not always possible, but sometimes the camera ship is quicker, better, and sometimes it's the other way around, but they should be fairly close in performance wise. The choice of the camera ship driver is also absolutely imperative. And normally, apart from one or two where we've heard it hasn't gone quite according to plan, we've got a regular two or three camera ship pilots that we've known for very many years. We trust implicitly with their lives and we will go ahead. But on the just before we do the photo shoot, we will sit down around a table and we will brief and plan exactly what we're going to do. And that's everything from, is the weather okay? Is the operating area going to be okay? What speeds are we going to be flying at? What radio frequencies are we going to use? What are the emergency procedures that we're going to, if anything happens, what are we going to do about it? And then we go through it and we go through all the process of the different views and photographs that we're going to be taking. Now, that whole routine, we have a pretty much a standard routine and we fly initially right-hand orbits, and then we go straight and level, and then we'll fly left-hand orbits, and then we'll go straight and level, and we'll fly some brakes. And there are variations throughout that. If the aeroplane that we're working with is aerobatic, we will put unusual attitude pictures at the end of the brief, and we'll fly those the very last thing. And the reason for that is, if anything doesn't go quite right during those, we've already got the main stuff in the bag, and we can get by. But it's interesting that the guys that fly the camera ships when we're doing unusual attitudes, the ones that we rely on most. But we go through that. We go out to the aeroplanes. We get airborne. We take off. And basically, we go do it. And once we've dealt with the photographs, which takes up about 20 minutes, camera ship and I break away, we come back and land back to base, and we leave Bob up there to fly the aeroplane and to examine its handling characteristics. It's a pretty well researched and proven process that we do, and I think because it's pretty much the same thing we do all the time, we know what's coming next.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it easy for Bob, who's got a go, you know, fly a new aeroplane and put it in formation and fly all these maneuvers that we want to get some extraordinary pictures. And he has to work very, very hard.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
As the book progresses, and as the reader, certainly the experience for me, as I got more and more into it, the words and the pictures actually became more meaningful, if that makes any sense. So as it progresses, it sort of becomes just one story, and the pictures tell as much as your mind is reading through the words. How do you go about that? Is that just the skill of the writing? Is it a mixture of the two? How does that synchronicity happen? Because it certainly happened for me.
Well, firstly, we had a good designer on the book, and he's somebody I've worked with on a number of projects, and he knew what it was that we wanted. And Bob and I worked out what the first chapter would look like, and then subsequent chapters were designed accordingly. Normally, the process is that my role is to illustrate Bob's words. So as Bob writes about a subject and he runs through the story and everything about it, the pictures should literally illustrate what Bob's talking about. And if you felt that that flowed very naturally, then clearly we got the picture selection and the image design and everything else just about right, which is delightful to hear. I'm really pleased. Thank you.
Yeah, and me and Keith,
we're a team, and we've been working like 20 how many years now. And one of the things that Keith won't tell you is that he's actually a brilliant journalist as well as a brilliant photographer. And so he helps me quite often with the way I lay out a story. And I've always said this, and I'm not disingenuous at all. I'm an amateur writer and Keith's the professional, because he can write about a boring aeroplane and I can't. It's just the way it is. And so when I'm dealing with something that I'm not all that fired up about, I get Keith to do it for me. And also, I've got some sort of mental aberration. I can't take photographs with a camera at all. But I do have an eye for a photograph. I'll give myself that. And I'll come up to Keith at the beginning of a shoot and say, look, what about this? What about that? And he'll always just take that on and we'll make that happen. And then quite often he'll say to me, what are you going to mention in this story about this aircraft so that I can go and take a picture of it? So quite often you'll find that when you get stuck in a little bit, if rather than just the ephemeral part of the beautiful pictures of the plane rolling over in a knife edge flyby or whatever, and you actually notice that when I'm in the story writing about, oh, that footstep's a bit weird, you put your foot here and you click this up, well, there's a picture of it. That's because me and Keith always work together on that stuff. So that's why it ties in, I'd say.
One of the styles that you have, and again, you know, I picked this up as I was reading through, is you're really open about ergonomics, discomfort in the cockpit, and fatigue as well, which I thought was quite interesting. Why is that so important to include in a flight test, do you think, rather than, you know, the traditional, let's just talk about how fast it goes and how maneuverable it is?
Well, one of the greatest compliments I've ever had, and I've had it quite a few times, is that I'm the aviation Jeremy Clarkson. And I love that, because I know I've heard he's a bit of a handful, but certainly he's the best journalist I've ever seen. And if I can get anywhere near what he does in a car, in a plane, I'm very, very humbled by that. That's a lovely thing to say about me. But over to you, Keith, what do you think?
I think as when you're writing a story, you can follow the process and therefore it becomes a very bland story. Whereas we wouldn't want to openly criticize somebody's pride and joy and say, this particular aeroplane is an absolute bag of nails. It's not fit for the sky. It's not there. However, you know, there are subtle ways of saying this isn't the greatest thing since sliced bread. And the ergonomics is something that in modern flying is very, very important. If you look at flight decks now of airliners, it's all about ergonomics. But even general aviation aircraft, or, you know, twins or small business jets, or going back to the workhorse aspect of it, ergonomics are really important. In warbirds, not so, because aircraft that were designed to fight during the war, it was a method of putting a machine gun in the air to shoot somebody down that was coming towards you. So ergonomics aren't quite so important. And the workload, again, you know, you're fighting for your life, so don't moan about it, get on with it. But with other aeroplanes, it's about the comfort and the luxury of flying it. And if you're going to go on a 4 or 5 hour flight somewhere in a single engine aeroplane, you've got to be comfortable. And if you're not, and Bob's going to be very quick to point that out. And I think it's important, because a lot of people would see an article of ours, read about it, and would then go looking for an aeroplane like that to buy for themselves. And a lot of it is based on Bob's judgment. So it's very, very important what he writes. It has to be truth. It has to be honest.
And my point, really, what I'm saying about Jeremy Clarkson is that he's just brutally honest, isn't he? I am brutally honest. I mean, I've had a big Polish fellow hold me off the floor by my collars once upon a time because I dared to slag off his pride and joy, this thing called a Soko Kragu. I think it was before you, wasn't it, Keith? I don't think you
did. It was, yes.
And this piece of junk that I flew, and I told it so, about 3 years later, he intercepted me at Elstree. They had to be fought off, you know, and I, hey, that's life. You know, I mean, we've just flown something. I won't say what it is, but we've just flown something that was a pile of crap as well. And, you know, and I did my best. In actual fact, Keith ended up writing the story because I got to about 1,500 words and I couldn't say anything more because it would just be slanderous. And Keith took the story, and Keith, the professional journalist among us, actually wrote it and got it up to about 2,900, didn't you?
Yes.
In the end, you know, so, I mean, I'm really lucky that I fly some incredible planes. But the problem with flying is that you, as a hobby, I'm obviously a professional pilot, but as a hobby, the other side of my life, which is the fun stuff that I do with military planes and warbirds and things, it's just a bigger drug. You fly at 150 miles an hour, you want to fly at 180, and then if you do that, you want to fly at 210, and if you do that, you want to fly at 250, and then one day you get this piece of crap that it climbs, cruises, and crashes at about 75 miles an hour. It's the most awful, terrible thing. And should we say what it is?
No, right. Don't. No, we mustn't upset. We mustn't upset the owner.
We better not.
Maybe we'll save that for another time when I can.
I think it'd be a good entry for book two, because we're going to make five of these books in the end.
Yeah,
and it might be a good thing to put it in.
I think one of the questions you asked earlier about the book and about progressing through it, I would like to think that whatever your particular interest in aviation is, whether it's the warbird end of the market, whether it's flying business jets, whether it's GA generally, whether it's aerobatic machines, whether it's learning about a simulator and how real it can be. Each of these stories in its own right, I think, is A, fascinating and well-written, and B, very nicely illustrated.
And do you, as the book, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of the warbirds, the jets and so forth. As the book migrates towards the workhorses, as they're described, what do you get the same sort of satisfaction out of those? I know we talked about speed and everything needs to be quicker, Bob, but, you know, some of those aircraft slightly more elegant or comfortable and less on the performance envelope. What sort of satisfaction do you get out of flying a really beautiful aeroplane like that?
I think that's like asking Lewis Hamilton how he'd feel about flying or driving a 2CV. You get used
good answer.
To high performance, and you just don't want to go back. There are exceptions. Yeah, I mean, open top flying is one example. Anything with a tail wheel is another one. We call the nose wheel on an aircraft the training wheel. The real proper aeroplanes have the wheel at the back, and so anything tail wheel is good. If I buy a little runaround, these days I work at Kemble Airport in Cotswolds, and I commute backwards and forwards from near Marlow in Essex, and I need a runaround. I'll buy even a slow aeroplane. I've just got to have a tail wheel. I can't ever bear to fly something with the nose wheel. It's like, you know, having outriggers on your bicycle. It's just a no-go zone for me. Some of them do have charm, but then I hand over to Keith and he writes the story because he's great at doing that.
I also think from my perspective, it doesn't have to be a 350 mile an hour warbird to be a challenge for me. My objective is to make that aeroplane look as beautiful as possible in its correct environment. When we photographed the Stinson, we did a lot of stuff at very low level over rough ground, because this aeroplane is painted in D-Day invasion stripes. So we wanted to make it look like it belonged in that place. Other ones where we photographed business jets, instead of taking them, we did it both. We did it high above the clouds where they would be normally working, but we've also taken them low level. I'm thinking particularly about the shoot in Guernsey, where we were flying around the lighthouse in a business jet while I was hanging out of a camera ship going flat out. But we always try and make the subject look beautiful and appealing. So when you pick the book up and you open it up, wherever you open it up, hopefully you go, that's nice. And that's probably my main aim, what I'm trying to achieve. As well as being informative, the pictures have to work with Bob's writing, but they should also please the person looking at them.
That's interesting, actually. Yeah. Quite know how to phrase the question, but I think it plays on from what I was talking about earlier in the writing complementing the visuals. It really makes a heck of a lot of difference. Now, one thing I did forget, Keith, and I'll be shot by every photographer out there who doesn't ask you this question, is what's your preference for the kit you use? And, you know, what sort of lenses, size lenses do you use on some of these shoots? Because they've, and one of the things about the book is a lot of books don't transmit the quality of a photograph very often. I think you've got it nailed in terms of sharpness and so forth. But tell us a little bit about your setup.
I have used the same manufacturer's kit for probably 45 or 50 years, and that's Nikon, or if Nikon, if you're an American listener. It's always been Nikon. And the problem, the reason why I chose to go down that route is purely that in the early days, very early days, I used to shoot with an Olympus camera, an OM1. The problem with that is it had fabric blinds in the back. So when the shutter worked, and the blinds would go in opposite directions to calculate the correct exposure, if you were pulling more than 3G, the blinds used to jam open or jam shut.
Yeah, of course.
So I was losing a lot of good pictures because I'm taking photographs of fast jets, you know, military stuff, and the pictures just weren't coming out. And I took advice, and it was actually the engineer at Olympus that said to me, you really need to go across to a titanium shutter camera, which is what I did. So I went down the Nikon route initially with the 4 cameras, which were massive investment. And I carried 2 of them. And I had a short lens and I had a long lens, an 80 to 200. Although invariably, the short lens was always the one that I used more. But when we went across to digital, and I was very lucky to be given a Nikon D1X on a photo shoot out in Colorado. And we were doing a photo shoot for a promotion of a brochure for a manufacturer out there. I'd taken out my Nikon film cameras and everything ready. And I said, have you arranged somewhere to process the film? And the guys went, what? No, you don't know your film. No, you're not using film. You're using digital. And I said, but I haven't got digital cameras. And they went, yes, you have. And they put these cameras on the desk and said, you've got these. You're using these. Apparently you use Nikon, don't you? Yes. Well, your lenses will work on these. Go use them. So I did 5 shoots that weekend, all with Nikon D1s. What I didn't tell the guys is that I was carrying film cameras in the aeroplane as well. And I shot everything twice, once on digital, once on film. Yeah. But thankfully, it worked. Now I'm working with Nikon D3Xs. I carry 4 of those and I've got short lenses for all of them. I've got longer lenses and I've also got ultra wide angle lenses, which I use for the detail, for the cockpit detail. But invariably, it's a medium length zoom that I use. I mean, when we use the term we fly in close formation, I mean, it's close formation. We're not sort of 100 feet apart. We're probably, what, 30 feet apart, Bob?
Or less.
Or less than 30 feet, yeah. So I don't need great big log lenses. The only time I need a real wide-angle lens in the air is if I'm capturing a landscape behind with a small version of the image in it, which is quite unusual, but I occasionally see the opportunity and take it. But invariably, I'm using high-end Nikon digital with very, very high-quality glass lenses. And it's the quality of the lens that delivers the quality of the picture.
Okay. We've talked safety and risk has come in a couple of times. And again, that's something in the reading of the book, Bob, you're very reluctant to glorify risk. You're very clear about how important it is to understand the risks involved in flying. How do you think sometimes others sort of lean a little bit more, you know, it's like we're talking about the P-51, lean towards the heroics in the writing rather than balancing it out with the risks associated with flying an aircraft like that?
I think that's all done and dusted now. I don't think people in the modern era do that. Prove how brilliant we are anymore and like grandiose what we're doing or anything like that. What we do with Keith and I, it's at the highest level. We're professional pilots and cameramen, so There is no anything grandiose about it at all. We're risk averse, completely risk averse. And we, as I said, we do this thing about three strikes and you're out. And those three strikes can come in quite quick. We had a shoot not that long ago in an aircraft, and the aircraft wasn't, there was the same number that Keith won't let me tell you what it was. That was strike one, you know, and then on the day we were compromised with the performance of the camera ship versus the aircraft to be tested. That was strike two. And it was a Sunday. And I think it was one of the best Sundays since Christmas. And the weather was fantastic. And everybody and their aunt was up flying. And we had aircraft coming at us from left, right and center. And that's three strikes. And we called it, didn't we, Keith?
We did indeed. I mean, the number of potential conflicts that were being called over the radio got so bad that it was difficult for me to actually give Bob requests a move for formation that day. And I think it was one of the better judgment calls you made. I probably would have battled on a little bit longer, but you took the decision for all of us. And there were four of us in the two aeroplanes. And we all got back to our base and we all sat down and drunk tea. And we all complained about how many aeroplanes were in the sky. And the good news was we were all sitting there laughing and joking about it, but we were still there. And that shows that the safety aspect is absolutely paramount. But no, I've had, not with flying with Bob, but with other people, I've had one mid-air collision doing this, and I don't ever want to get anything like that again. It made me far more focused on who I flew with. So now I actually, apart from in the US, in the UK, I will only fly with three people to do this kind of work. And obviously Bob is, in my opinion, top of the tree.
Well, let's put you both on the spot then from the book. I know we've talked a few of the aircraft in there, not all of them, so there's plenty still to see. But Bob, let me put you on the spot first. Favorite from the book? Why? Speed? Power?
It's, if I was a Patriot, well, I am, but everybody goes about Spitfires. The Mustang is just the best World War II fighter. It's just fantastic. And ironically, unlike the two-seat Spits, the TF-51s, the two-seaters, or the P-51 single-seaters, they fly better with somebody in the back. And in the manual, if you dig it down, it actually says, if you're flying solo cross-country in a P-51, that's the single-seater, put 22 gallons of fuel in the back seat tank, and that's the weight of a man and a parachute. And I've got a mate in America who flies a single-seat Mustang and a two-seat Mustang, and he said the TF flies better.
Wow, interesting. How about you, Keith? Favourite from the book?
Well, that's difficult. I like all of them. There's not much in there that I don't like. I think I would pick two, and they're slightly esoteric. One's the Quest Air Venture, which we flew out in North Carolina, a flying egg, which is one of the most unusual looking but fast little hot ships. And I think you described it admirably as a productionized kit plane. It's quite an amazing piece of kit. And I remember your reaction when you looked at it, when it taxied up onto the ramp and you said, I'm going to fly that. Well, actually, yes, you did. And you flew it nicely. But the camera ship pilot actually turned around to us and before we took off to do the photo shoot. And he went, last time I saw one of those, it was hanging in a tree. And we thought, great. But, you know, it was a good story. But my other favorite in the book, and there are very personal reasons for that, is the Slingsby Firefly. And that's twofold. One is because Bob's writing about it is Jeremy Clarkson-esque. I mean, he really takes to task certain attributes about this aeroplane. And as he relates in the story, he tested it very early on in its production career. So our revisit to Essex to fly this one was a second time around. And in many ways, you knew what to expect. But you were flying it with somebody that knew the aeroplane intimately. But we also got to do a very interesting, unusual attitude shoot with the aeroplane where the Firefly was upside down. We were flying around it. And on this occasion, Bob was actually the camera ship driver for me. But my, bless her good wife, was the only person that would volunteer to fly as passenger in the aeroplane. Because it was a two-seater, nobody else from the flying club down there would get in it because they knew what we were going to do. And bless her, she said, well, yeah, I'll go and do it. And in the pictures, she's got long blonde hair in a ponytail And for most of them, her hair is hanging down, upside down, and brushing on the canopy. So those actually bring back some happy memories. Every one of the photo shoots that we've done, every single one of those articles in the book, I can relay a story about something about it, all of them. And as Bob has alluded to, I'm getting close to doing 2,000 different aeroplanes now. And I can still sort of recall things from every single one of them, which is quite amazing. So happy memories.
So if there was one thing you'd want a reader to take away from reading Warbirds to Workhorses, what would you hope that would be?
Don't know. I just love that coffee table book thing from the 70s as a child. I just remember how excited I was every Christmas that I'd just get another one of these books. And before I actually learned to fly myself, and just this incredible world opening, the glory of flight. And I used to lay on my back in the grass looking up at the sky and see the beautiful cumulus clouds, thinking one day I'd love to fly a jet plane or something high performance around the clouds. I think we're trying to invigorate the reader in our books that's what it's all about, is this incredible thing that you can do. And I like the accessibility as well, and I think that's why I'm quite human about like my fear and my reluctant sometimes about what we're doing, that I'm just normal. So's Keith's a pilot too, and we're just normal human beings, and you should go out there and maybe get involved yourself. If there's one single person that walks up to me in the future and says, your book was the inspiration for me to learn to fly, I'm sold.
Excellent.
From my perspective, it's all about hoping that the reader picks up the book and sits down and enjoys it. It's the sort of book that you know, it's got 15 chapters on 15 different aircraft. If you read one chapter a day, that's gives you 50, a good couple of goes at it. And I'm sure that those people that are into the aircraft stories will go back and read them over and over again. That's the great thing about a coffee table book. It should be forever enjoyment. And I sincerely hope that what we've delivered to the readers is forever enjoyment.
So where, Keith, can we find a copy of the book? Where can listeners buy it?
Well, assuming that your listeners are all UK-based, although they probably won't be, let's start with the UK. Obviously, the biggest seller of the book is obviously going to be Amazon, and they currently have quite a good stock of them. You can, in fact, go directly to the Pen and Sword website, which is probably preferable, but there are a number of places that are offering the book for sale. But thankfully, there's also lots and lots of bookshops in the UK that have also stocked it and have it for sale. And that includes things like museum shops and event shops and airports and things. So generally, it's all over the place. If you've got readers in Europe, again, go on to and Google where you can buy it in your own country. I know that there are quite a few bookshops all over Europe that are stocking it. And I also know there's at least 5 bookshops in America that are already stocking it. So hopefully enjoy it, but let us know what you think of it. You know, if you're going to buy a book, mm-hmm. go up there and write what you think of it and let us know.
Yeah.
Because we like the feedback.
Please.
Yeah.
Please come back. Reviews.
How do they do that? Where can we find you guys online?
Well, sadly, us guys aren't online. We're too old to worry about things like that.
I don't know. Bob's got a good Facebook page, I hear.
Well, by the same token, yeah. I've got a Facebook page as well. So both of us are on Facebook, but neither of us have our own websites because
that's fine.
We don't have the time to maintain it. Quite often when you buy books, certainly through someone like Amazon or through Pen and Sword, there are opportunities to go back and provide feedback on the book. And certainly for me, I'm sure for you, Bob, we really like to hear what people think of it.
Yeah, we'd love to know. And we would either modify book 2 accordingly, or we wouldn't produce book 2 if I don't like it very much. I mean, we put a big speech on last night with 100 people in the room, and we sold 10 books, and I just said, that's a bit disappointing. It didn't matter, but And someone said, well, no one reads books anymore. They're all on, you know, iPads and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love having a book in my hand. And
so
and
do I.
I'm glad you said that. To, you know, to be able to roll over at 3 a.m. when you can't sleep and just open a book and read for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or to take one with you on a trip and stick it in your luggage and just that lovely experience of having something that you can open. Staring at a bloody iPad doesn't do it for me at all. I mean, we've done our iPad thing, you know, we've done our, what's it called, Keith?
I know. I'm the same. Listen, there's a really good Facebook group for aviation books as well. So we'll post this episode onto that side. It's run by a guy called Simon. And I pretty much guarantee that almost 100% of the people on that who follow him, he's got a couple of thousand people who follow him, they all like hard copy books too. So we'll make sure we promote it there. And we've even got a bookshop, so we'll put it on there as well.
Thank you very
fascinating,
much.
Fascinating insights. Thank you so much for spending a bit of time telling us about it. Looking forward to what comes next. And Bob, just before we go, did I see this week that you've been announced to fly at the New Hampshire Air Show?
Yes. So, yeah, I'm flying the Yak 3 at Thruxton. Is it September, I think, sometime?
Yes, in September. Yeah. That's right.
And I'm hoping to get a book in at Old Warden as well this year, which I'm really excited about because those people are just the best hosts for visiting pilots that you can possibly get. They're lovely. Also, on the back of our presentations that we've been doing, we're doing an Old Warden one, I think, and we're doing a Light Aircraft Association, LAA, at Terwestern. Just look out for it on the net that we might actually be bringing the books and bringing our presentation to you people out there.
Well, drop me a line and we'll help promote that through our social media stuff as well. So send us a note and we'll try and help promote it as well. Listen, guys, thank you so much for joining us today.
Very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music. And I'd like to thank all of you who listen and follow us. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can find Tim, Ellie and Gareth on the extended social feeds. That's Instagram, Facebook, Threads, Blue Sky, LinkedIn and Twitter. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Bob.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Keith.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.